I was alone with the President of the United States, or the President-elect, soon to be President. The subject matter, I was talking about matters that touch on the FBI's core responsibility and that relate to the President, President-elect, personally. And then the nature of the person. I was honestly concerned that he might lie about the nature of our meeting, and so I thought it really important to document.
Damning testimony from former FBI Director James Comey yesterday. Today, what damage was done to Donald Trump and his administration? Anything? And where does the Democratic Party go? Does it go full anti-Trump all the time, or does the party need to talk issues? Should it move to the center? Really interesting debate going on there. We'll get to that in just a moment. First, though, let's talk about Trump, Comey, and the Russia story with McKay Coppins, writer for The Atlantic, and he spent a lot of time covering Donald Trump. Hi there.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, let's start with the big picture. Today, 24 hours later, where does Donald Trump stand?
Well, at the moment, he's actually standing at the White House for a press
conference
right as we speak. Yes. It's interesting. I talked to a former Trump campaign advisor right after Comey's testimony yesterday. And asked the advisor, you know, was this a good day, bad day for Trump? Obviously, you see the White House out there making the case that Trump was vindicated by Comey's testimony, and at the same time making a case against Comey, saying that he's not trustworthy, that he exposed himself for being kind of a political actor more than anything. This advisor, though, this former Trump advisor, told me that it was not a good day for Trump because the testimony, regardless of what you think of the president, it is not helpful to have a nationally televised, high-profile congressional hearing that, you know, the whole country is watching, and you have a former FBI director coming out and saying that the president is a liar, that the president fired him to impede an investigation into Russian interference with the election, and basically sharing a lot of the juicy details of their various interactions that, at least coming from Comey's perspective, were not very flattering for the president.
Right. And you have the Republican senators on the committee pointedly ignoring the talking points that the Republican National Committee sent out, which were to basically malign James Comey and his character. In fact, they went the opposite, just falling all over themselves to say what a great American he is. So what does that say to you in terms of their shifting attitudes, if they are shifting, toward the president?
Well, I was struck by that as well. Like you said, the White House's line here has been to attack Comey. That's what the Trump administration has wanted to do. The line of defense was, you know, we're going to just go on a full-out blitz on Comey. You even saw, in fact, a nonprofit political group that was a pro-Trump political group air a campaign commercial that aired on cable news attacking James Comey. I was struck by the fact that, like you said, the senators did not only not attack Comey, they went out of their way to compliment him, to say he was a great public servant, that he was well known for his honesty and integrity, to thank him for his service. To me, that does suggest some possible, even if it's small and even if it's temporary, some shifting power dynamics in Washington. The fact that all of those senators up on that, in that hearing, none of the Republican senators seemed willing to buy the White House's line and advance it, suggests to me that Republicans sense that this president is weak. The recent Quinnipiac poll just this week ahead of the hearing has Trump's approval rating down to 34%. Mm-hmm. I think Republicans in Washington know that he's weak, know that the agenda that they care about, the legislative agenda, has not been making very much progress. And there's a lot of reluctance now in the GOP to go out of your way to defend the president. That's not to say that they're going to break with him, but it doesn't seem like Republicans seem extremely eager to board the Trump train once again and go all in defending him.
So far from the cloud being lifted, the cloud just lingers on, settles in.
I think that's right. I mean, the one fear that I hear from Republicans behind the scenes, just in this last couple days, is that it is a mistake for Trump to try to enter into a credibility contest with James Comey. And, you know, anyone who watched that hearing yesterday, whatever you think of Comey's decisions and his judgment, he was very careful in his testimony. He was trying to be very candid. He even criticized himself at points. And his testimony was based on, he says, meticulous notes that he took throughout his time working with Donald Trump. And I think that people watching him and then people knowing how Trump kind of operates and his, I think the charitable assessment of his rhetorical style is to call it freewheeling, but to kind of place those two people next to each other and tell Americans choose who to believe, I'm not sure is the best strategy for the Trump White House.
McKay Coppins, writer for The Atlantic and author of the book The Wilderness, Deep Inside the Republican Party's Combative, Contentious, Chaotic Quest to Take Back the White House. McKay, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, you'd think that all this focus on Trump and the Russia investigation would be good for Democrats. And it's true, many are working the controversy for all it's worth. But not all donkeys are rejoicing. In fact, some liberal Democrats are saying it's time to drop the focus on Russia and get back to the issues. One group making that argument is the California Nurses Association. And joining me now is its Director of Government Relations, Don Nielsen. Welcome to you.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us, Lisa Hagan, reporter at NPR station WABE in Atlanta, where she's covering the much-watched congressional race to replace Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price. Hi, Lisa.
Hi there.
And Josh Kraushaar. He's politics editor at the National Journal. Hi, Josh.
Hey, good to be on.
Great to have you. Okay, Don, let's begin with you. Why do you think Democrats should stop focusing on the Russia investigation?
Well, it isn't so much stop, it's pay attention to the rest of the issues that the public cares about and that their base cares about. People are tired of Russia, Russia, Russia all the time, and they want to hear more about the issues that affect them directly, like health care. We're pushing a bill, SB 562, in the California legislature right now that's gotten over to the Assembly. More than 70% of the Californians support it, and it's the type of issue that is taking over the Democratic Party base and that the party needs to get.
This is the universal
health
care bill that you're talking
Pardon
about?
Pardon me?
This is the universal health care bill you're talking about?
Yes, single-payer, Medicare for all.
Yeah.
Right.
Okay, so I guess the issue there in Washington, at least, is that the Democrats are the minority party, so there's only so much they can do when it comes to legislation.
Well, that's true, but why are they the minority party? They've been pursuing a loser strategy for a long time now, which is to go to the middle, and the base is tired of it. It's why some of that base went over to Trump. Some of those people who voted for Trump voted for Bernie Sanders in the primary because both of those candidates talked to the issues that the base cares about. Bernie Sanders authentically, Donald Trump inauthentically, disingenuously. The reality is the Democrats are losing their base as time goes by, and it's because they're not supporting the issues that their base cares about.
Josh, let me bring you in here. Are you hearing that on a national level?
Not entirely. The Democratic base is fired up and ready to go to take a page from President Obama's line. And the problem and the challenge that strategists across the board for Democrats are facing is they're having trouble persuading sort of those voters that didn't like either Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, that are sort of these suburban mom centrist suburban voters. And as Lisa knows, we're seeing that in Georgia's 6th congressional district, where it's a very affluent Republican leaning district that does not like Donald Trump, views him fairly unfavorably, but also isn't in love with the National Democratic Party leadership, views it as a little too liberal for their tastes. So the key, and then the Democratic nominee, John Ossoff, who has gotten over $20 million in mostly liberal donations, is running a very moderate message and doing it successfully. He's not talking about Russia. He's not even talking about the health care bill all that much, but he's talking about traditional Republican issues, and he's talking in a pro-business with a pro-business message that's actually trying to win over some of these swing, independent-minded voters. And those are the key voters for Democrats going forward if they want to take back control of Congress.
Lisa, can you amplify that? Talk a little bit more about John Ossoff's strategy.
Yeah, for sure. It's been interesting to watch over here, and it's so interesting talking to folks in California. John Ossoff has had to stay away from even using the word Democrat when he goes out and speaks in debates, in events. He tries to say, I'm going to be an independent voice here, and yeah, he very much, he's been amplifying this thing about cutting wasteful spending, which is something I think you hear all the time from mm-hmm. Republicans here. Just definitely not trying to amplify this picture that he painted sort of early on as, make Trump furious. He's not trying to look like a liberal here to win this race.
But this is in a district that's not a liberal district at all. right?
That's right. It's been Republican since 1979.
Right. And so this is not a typical district that Democrats would compete in successfully.
Exactly right. But I mean, he's been doing pretty incredibly here. It's an incredibly tight race. We just got a new poll out saying that he's finally above the margin of error by about 3 points here to win, which is a total. I mean, if this happens here, it's quite an upset.
So but also he's spending more money than anyone has ever spent. Right. In terms of a congressional race. So we're up to 23 million on his side.
More than 23 million. That's right. And I think 15 million of that just since the primary that we had here in April.
Okay. So, and a lot of that obviously from outside the district. How big a deal is this, if you can characterize it in terms of maybe an earthquake metaphor, in terms of national politics for the Democrats this race?
Well, we have tornadoes, not earthquakes over here. But
you're talking to Californians, so
it's humongous. I mean, it's way over what any other. It's breaking records over here. It's really, really irritating. I think a lot of the people in the district, because all of that money is going into ads here. I mean, you can't go anywhere literally without turning on the TV and seeing John Ossoff and Karen Handel ads here. And people are really, really tired of it, for sure.
And how often does the word Trump come up in campaign ads and in campaigning?
So little. I mean, I think Handel here, you know, has during the primaries, she was in a crowded field of Republicans, and so many people running in the Republican race, you know, were trying to compete for being like, I'm Trump's best friend. I'm Trump's best friend. And Handel sort of stayed away from that. Now, she's more reluctantly accepted his support and said, you know, of course, why would I not want the president to campaign for me and support me here? But certainly it's been a very tricky line for her to walk, because in this district, you know, Hillary Clinton only missed by under 2 points here. So it's sort of this like third line kryptonite. Both don't really want to touch it. Anytime they bring up Trump, it's a reminder of the fact that, you know, this race is not about the district itself, which is a message that both candidates are really trying to stay away from.
Don Nielsen, back to you, Don Nielsen of the California Nurses Association. When you hear this report from Georgia and the success that John Ossoff has had going to the middle and not mentioning health care and not mentioning the issues that you think that Democrats should mention and yet being successful, what does that say to you?
Well, it's an aberration in relation to the rest of the country. This is not the key to success for the Democrats across the country. The reality is Bernie Sanders did as well as he did during the primaries because he appealed to working class issues. That's what's missing from the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party can't have it both ways. I mean, so you elect somebody in Georgia who is what, a Republican light or something? The reality is we've got to have candidates that appeal to the base, that excite the base, that get them out in the large numbers that we saw where Bernie Sanders almost pulled off the upset. The fact that Hillary Clinton wasn't able to beat Donald Trump, of all people, I mean, that's pathetic, and it's because the middle part of the country, you know, the working class, those states that they need to get in order to win in the Electoral College, just don't see the Democrats appealing to their issues, and they've got to get back to that, or they're going to continue to see more and more of what they saw in November.
So you think focusing on Russia is a losing issue, or focusing on impeachment, that's a losing issue?
Well, it's not enough. People want to hear. They don't want to just hear what's wrong with the other side, right? And when you organize people, you have to organize around positive issues. They don't want to just hear what's wrong with Trump. Everybody knows what's wrong with Trump. They want to know what the Democrats offer as an alternative. And so what is the alternative? Is it just, you know, we're going to get Trump? We're going to go after him? Okay, then what? Then we get Mike Pence? I mean, we need a real solution. The Democrats need to appeal to the working class values that both Bernie Sanders and Trump did. And as a result, you know, Bernie Sanders did very well in the primaries, much better than anybody anticipated. And Donald Trump did well, appealing to those issues disingenuously again, right? I mean, he said, you know, jobs are going overseas, TPP and NAFTA, economic justice issues. That appeals to middle America because they see their economic situation getting worse and worse, not better. And so when somebody like a Donald Trump comes along and appeals to those issues, again, disingenuously, he's able to steal just enough to pull off a small margin of victory in those Midwestern states. Whereas Bernie Sanders did it authentically, and the Democrats want nothing to do with that. The Democratic leadership, rather, wants nothing to do with that, and it's tragic because that's where the base is.
Josh, when you're looking at the midterms and beyond, are you seeing any candidates on the national stage who are actually doing that or changing the direction of the Democratic Party in the direction that Don suggests is needed?
Well, look, Ossoff is the one providing the playbook for the Democratic Party. And where I disagree with his assessment is that the very bellwether seats that disproportionately make up the House battlegrounds are in districts just like Georgia 6. They're affluent. They're suburban. They're filled with centrist, center-right types of voters that Republicans have held for a long time but overwhelmingly swung towards Hillary Clinton. She actually did a lot better than Obama did in many of these same districts. So Democrats need to pick up 24 of them. If you actually look at this Georgia 6 race, it's a perfect bellwether. It's number 28 on the list of the most Democratic seats that Republicans hold based on the 2016 election results. So the playbook that Ossoff is doing is really being embraced by other Democrats. And look, if you're competing in Montana or a working class district in Michigan, you're going to have a different political playbook. But unfortunately for Don, most of these big Republican battlegrounds are these affluent suburban seats where Bernie Sanders didn't do very well in the presidential primaries. So it's not the map that's playing towards the populist wing of the Democratic Party.
So are you saying that the congressional calculus is different than the presidential calculus when it comes to attracting these voters?
The House calculus specifically is different, just because the House map leans a little bit Republican because of the way the districts are drawn. So to win a majority, you have to, win over a few Republican voters. You have to win over some independent voters that tend to vote Republican. And that's the math.
Okay, so what about the White House, though? What about in 4 years?
Well, it depends whether Trump is on the ballot again. It depends on a whole lot of different factors for the Democratic Party. But I guarantee you're going to see a big fight nationally between the wing of the party that Don represents, the Bernie wing, who want to really take over the party and want to change the party's message. And you'll see a more pragmatist approach that is being adopted by other party leaders. And that's going to be a huge divide in the run-up to 2020.
Don, a final question for you. There's a fight going on here in California over the head of the Democratic Party. And I'm just wondering about this idea of party unity. Isn't the party stronger when it is united than instead of just having these internal battles over the direction of where the party should go and who should lead it?
Well, by all means, unity is important, and everybody wants unity. But unity for unity's sake alone is not enough. It's got to be about what are we going to unify around, and that's the point. The Democrats aren't able to. The Democratic leadership is not able to unify the party around this same old a tired agenda of being too close to Wall Street, not caring enough about American jobs being shipped overseas, not caring enough about health care. The New York Times had a great article a few days ago about how the single payer is now becoming, Medicare for all is now becoming the litmus test for Democrats, right? It is shifting to the left and to that issue, among others, because that's what the base wants. And if you want to unify, you have to unify around those issues.
All right, we'll leave it there. Don Nielsen, Director of Government Relations for the California Nurses Association. Josh Kraushauer is politics editor at the National Journal. And Lisa Hagen, reporter at WABE. That's Atlanta's NPR station. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thanks.
All right. We would like to hear from you on this topic. Do you think Democrats should drop the Russia investigation and focus on other issues, or just, pull back their focus on the Russia investigation and include other issues? What do you think of the idea of single payer? Should the Democrats focus on that? You can weigh in on Facebook and Twitter at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, why women understood what James Comey was going through alone in the Oval Office with Donald Trump on Valentine's Day, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. All right, we're going to go one more round on yesterday's Comey testimony, specifically what many women heard in his descriptions of dealing with his boss, President Trump. Robin Abkarian of the LA Times is here now. She's one of a number of columnists who were struck by yesterday's statements. Hi.
Indeed. Yes.
And also his written opening statement.
Well, it was the written opening statement, actually, that got me.
Okay. Well, let's play something that he said yesterday. This is an exchange he had with California Senator Dianne Feinstein.
You're big, you're strong. I know the Oval Office, and I know what happens to people when they walk in. There is a certain amount of intimidation. But why didn't you stop and say, Mr. President, this is wrong. I cannot discuss this with you.
It's a great question. Maybe if I were stronger, I would have. I was so stunned by the conversation that I just took it in. And the only thing I could think to say, because I was playing in my mind, because I was going to remember every word he said, I was playing in my mind, what should my response be? And that's why I very carefully chose the words. And look, I've seen the tweet about tapes. Lordy, I hope there are tapes. I remember saying, I agree he's a good guy, as a way of saying I'm not agreeing with what you just asked me to do. Again, maybe other people would be stronger in that circumstance, but that's how I conducted myself. I hope I'll never have another opportunity. Maybe if I did it again, I would do it better.
All right, Robin. Does that sound familiar?
Oh, my God. What woman cannot relate to that, Madeline? It was like it's every woman in every situation with a boss who is overbearing, asking her to do something she doesn't want to do. She's so stunned. She doesn't know how to react and just kind of files it away for later. And later, when confronted, people say, well, what's wrong with you? You should have said something. Why? I mean, Dianne Feinstein saying you're big and strong. This is like a complete inversion.
This is a 6'8" man.
Yeah, of the usual male-female dynamic. Like, and now Comey's manhood is being challenged by Trump surrogates for not standing up.
Did you? I thought of Anita Hill a little bit.
Oh, totally. Oh, yes, absolutely. It reminded me of the Anita Hill Clarence Thomas hearings, where the whole sort of Republican and even Democratic line against mm-hmm. Anita Hill was, what's wrong with you? You should have spoken up. You didn't say anything. You followed him to a new job. This is, I mean, you're talking about people's careers on the line. We've all been in a situation where we've been made uncomfortable, and you make this calculus. Okay, do I say something and get fired or demoted? Or disfavored? Or do I just kind of save it for when I need it?
And also kind of blaming yourself. He was doing that in that clip, saying, absolutely. I wish I had been stronger. I wasn't strong enough.
Right, exactly. Which is, you know, for a guy in his position who's the FBI director, that's a remarkable thing to say.
Yeah.
I mean, that shows the power imbalance even in the Oval Office.
So also describe a little bit what struck you from his written testimony, because he kind of goes through all the meetings
right.
that he had with Donald Trump. And what stood out for you?
Well, what stood out for me was initially their first meeting when Comey asked to stay afterwards with the president-elect and told him about that Russian dossier, which mm-hmm. was he described it as salacious and unverified information. So that, I think, somehow in Trump's mind must have created a special bond that they had, that thing that he later told Comey about. So that later, when he asked everybody to leave the office and just let him talk to James Comey by themselves, which was clearly so inappropriate, and then they had a dinner that James Comey thought would have other people at it, and it was just the two of them. And the president, again, wanted to talk about loyalty and, you know, that thing we had and make sure that Comey was on his side. And Comey was sitting there uncomfortable, not knowing what to do. You know, he wanted to scream and run for the door.
Right. And then that other incident where there were a bunch of people in the Oval and he was trying to blend into the drapes.
Oh, yes. That was right after the inauguration when Donald Trump had gathered law enforcement officials to thank them for their work during the inauguration. Comey had to show up, he felt, because he represented the FBI. But he didn't want to be singled out by Trump. So he was wearing a blue suit that matched the blue drapes in the office they were. And he, you can see in the video, he backs up against the drapes, like, don't look at me, don't look at me. The president spots him, you know, like a laser beam, and calls him over. Says, oh, you're getting more famous than I am, shakes his hand and tries to like pull him in for a hug, which Donald Trump does this weird, like, I don't know if it's a primate behavior or what, but he does this thing where he grips your
yeah,
hand and pulls you into him.
Handshake thing.
And
yeah.
He tried to do that to Comey and Comey resisted. We've all been there, right? When somebody tries to go in for the hug.
The unwanted hug.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ugh. Well, do you think Comey realized that he was actually experiencing the same thing that many women have experienced?
No. I think he was completely clueless about that. And I think that's what's been so instructional, I think, for Americans and people watching, is that finally maybe people will see that this is not just a female-male dynamic, that it's a power dynamic. And it happens in relationships where there's a power imbalance. So, you know, mm-hmm. So hopefully the next time this happens to a woman, people will get it.
Yeah, no matter how tall, big, and strong you are.
Exactly.
Robin Abkarian, she's a columnist at the LA Times, where you can read her column on this very topic. Robin, thanks for coming
in. Thanks, Madeline. It was great.
All right, Working Women of Los Angeles, what was your reading of Comey's testimony? You can weigh in on our Facebook page at KCRW Press Play. Coming up, it's movie time. There's a Tom Cruise film out this weekend. It's called The Mummy. Our reviewers say it really should have stayed buried.
It's a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox, and it's delivered with all the visual panache of somebody saying, here, I guess.
The Mummy, plus a thriller from writer Daphne du Maurier. It's called My Cousin Rachel. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Friday, so time for a little break from the news, and we'll get some movie reviews. Coming up on the program, we're going to talk to the writer-director of one of this week's movies. But first, let's talk about those movies with William Bibbiani, film critic for Crave Online, and he also hosts the podcast Canceled Too Soon. Hi.
Hello.
And Kyle Buchanan, senior editor at New York Magazine's Vulture, where he writes about film. Hi, Kyle.
Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Let's start with the movie that seems like it could be the biggest box office draw this weekend, The Mummy, starring Tom Cruise.
I saw her. She is real.
Please meet Princess Amunet. She will claim what she has been denied.
Kyle, is she denied Tom Cruise? Will she claim him?
She's trying her damnedest to do it. Just as Universal is doing its damnedest to launch this new cinematic universe based on all of the old monster movies that they once had. So they're starting with The Mummy, but they hope to incorporate The Invisible Man, Bride of Frankenstein, a whole lot of other things. Perhaps putting the cart before the horse too soon, because this version of The Mummy is not so good.
It's not, no. It's this is the sort of cartoon kind of pablum we would get in the 1980s. Like, if you were going to do like a Universal Monsters cartoon action series, they were going to sell a lot of action figures. This is what I would expect, but it's not the kind of exciting, engaging summer entertainment action horror hybrid. The action's okay, the horror is weak. That launches a series. Mm. Like, I
you're
can
thinking Raiders of the Lost Ark, but it's not anywhere near that.
I wouldn't even say Raiders of the Lost Ark. I think the Brendan Fraser version of The Mummy was trying to be Raiders of the Lost Ark, and I think it was an okay Raiders knockoff. I think this new Mummy doesn't know what it is. I think it's kind of going for a superhero vibe, but it takes a long time to get there, and in the meantime, it's just generic pap.
It's a Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox, and it's delivered with all the visual panache of somebody saying, here, I guess.
There's no wit, and there's no real sensitivity to the idea that this is a horrifying monster. I think they sort of forgot that these are horror characters, and they treated them as sort of dark supervillains. And I think the appeal of the universal monsters, I think the thing you want to take advantage of when you have a universal monster is the idea that these are anti-heroes or anti-villains. All of the original universal monsters are very sympathetic creatures, and here it feels just like a star vehicle for Tom Cruise, and Tom Cruise feels miscast because he's playing a guy who isn't supposed to be that likable. And he's just putting on the charm.
Do we even need to go through the plot of this? Or?
We really don't. There's a mummy and there's Tom Cruise. But yeah, boy, does he feel miscast. This just feels like he only did it because he had a window in his schedule. He's playing this like roguish sex stud, which I just don't think is how we think of Tom Cruise in his mid-50s, if we ever truly did.
But isn't that what he does in Mission Impossible?
Well,
no,
not quite. He's not,
never sexy.
He's not trying to be sexual in that. What he does in Mission
Manly,
Impossible,
I suppose.
Sure. But what he does in that movie and what he does well in most of his movies, especially his action movies, is his full throttle commitment to whatever he's doing. And this character isn't like that. He's a lot more ambivalent and whatever about things, and that's not Tom Cruise's best mode. I mean, it feels like it was written for our current bevy of young action stars named Chris. And Tom Cruise was like, I'll take it, and nobody had the cojones to say, maybe this isn't the best
fit. And I think any of the Chris's would have done a better job.
Yeah.
Moving on to an indie, Beatrice at Dinner, starring Salma Hayek. Here's a clip.
I couldn't be more pleased at how smoothly this whole process has gone. Alex, if any of those efforts were illegal, I do not know you, nor was I even here tonight.
Neither was I, and it's my house.
I would just like to say to Kathy and Grant, thank you for having me. When I first came to the United States a long time ago...
Did you come legally?
Yes.
Oh, this tenderloin was amazing.
So was the fish, so buttery.
Okay, so Kyle, this is Selma Hayek playing Beatrice. She is obviously a fish out of water at this dinner party. What did you think?
I think she's really terrific in this role. We haven't seen Selma Hayek play something this grounded and centered in a long time. And the movie is, the timing really couldn't be better for this film. She's playing this Los Angeles healer who is very out of place at this dinner party for one of her clients, a wealthy client who invites Trump-like developer John Lithgow to dinner. And the way that the two of them sort of circle each other and face off is going to be uncomfortably relevant, I think, for anyone in this sort of Trump era who feels very sensitive to other people suffering and really doesn't know what to do about it, given how rapacious corporate interests seem to be these days and unchecked.
Yeah. And so was this movie made in response to this era, the Trump era, do you know? Or?
Well, it was made last year, obviously, as Trump was a pretty relevant figure in the primaries and then going into the election. It debuted at the Sundance Film Festival in January, right during Trump's inauguration. So to say the very least, it's, you know, completely tied to its times. And I think that it's sensitively made. There's like a handful of jokes that I would have initially dismissed as maybe a little too on the nose. However, in today's climate, I'm really not sure if we can get more on the nose than the things that are actually happening in the world. So maybe, if anything, they're underplaying it.
I think we're in a really, really interesting time for cinema in terms of politics, because the movies that we're getting now were made during the last election cycle. And I think there's a lot of movies that are getting made, you know, about politics or around social issues that may have been made under the assumption that Donald Trump didn't win the White House, or may have been made under pretenses about climates that no longer exist or that have since exploded. And so I'm very fascinated to see movies like this that are about something and were made before we knew what it was going to be. And I think it's going to be real interesting to look back like 5 years from now.
I think you walk out of this movie sort of asking yourself the big questions, which are, what do we do about the state of the world, and can we do anything to change it? You know, it's nice to see that there is a movie already that's grappling with these things that are intimately, uncomfortably familiar to a lot of us right now.
I will say that I heard the filmmaker struggled with the ending, that he didn't know exactly which version he should choose. We're not going to give it away.
Well, there's an ambiguity to the way that it ends. I think there's an ambiguity to our current moment, so maybe it's fitting.
Okay, good. Let's move on to something scarier than a dinner party confrontation. My Cousin Rachel stars Rachel Weisz as the Cousin Rachel. Here's a clip.
Whatever it cost my cousin in pain and suffering before he died, I will return in full measure upon the woman that caused it.
She's here.
What are you going to do with her?
Confront her.
Okay, so that's William, based on a novel by Daphne du Maurier, who wrote Rebecca and the Birds.
And Don't Look Now, she's written some of the best sort of suspenseful social kind of thrillers of the 20th century, and she's led to some of the best movies of the 20th century.
And this takes place in the 19th century, right?
Yes, it does. This is a gothic story, I think, in a lot of classical ways. It's about a young man. He grew up without women, and now his benefactor, it's his cousin who raised him, goes off, marries someone, he never meets this woman, and then he dies under mysterious circumstances. And now this young man is just like, well, I'm going to get her. And then it turns out she's Rachel Weisz, who is charming and lovely and sexy, and he doesn't know what to do with that. It is about a story about a man who has never encountered women, who now has to start all over from scratch. And the movie wants you to wonder, maybe he's just getting his comeuppance and maybe women are totally awesome. Or maybe she actually did kill his adopted father and all of his suspicions were accurate. And whenever the movie lets you think either one is plausible, it's fantastic. It is creepy, disturbing, suspenseful, romantic, again, very, very sexy. About two-thirds of the way through, it kind of just picks a side. And I think the momentum of the movie kind of stops. But by the end of it, I think it reaches a conclusion that is very valuable, is very meaningful, and I think is totally worth the journey. And I think Rachel Weisz is one of our most underappreciated actors, and she knocks this one out of the park. She's fantastic.
Not cast necessarily for her name.
No, what a great coincidence, yeah. Right? No, she's fantastic. I see a lot of these articles nowadays about how, oh, Nicole Kidman, like every couple of years, we suddenly remember that Nicole Kidman is one of the best actors in the world. I'm waiting for someone to remember that Rachel Weisz is too, because she's always fantastic, even in movies that don't necessarily deserve her. But this is a really, really good one, and I would recommend it.
Okay. Up next, I'm going to be speaking with Trey Edward Schultz. He's the writer and director of our next movie, It Comes at Night, and it stars Joel Edgerton. Here's a clip.
When we're inside the house, the door to the back room stays closed and locked, the one that you came through, and the door leading to the back room also stays closed and locked all the time.
Okay, so Kyle, what did you think of this movie? It's a horror movie.
Yeah, it's that's one of the key questions about what this is. You know, certainly if I gave you the synopsis, which is it's about this sort of end of the world post-apocalyptic scenario where a family led by Joel Edgerton is wary of the strangers that they come across. Do they mean them ill? Might they spread this ambiguous infection that has supposedly decimated the land? Then yes, you're going to be thinking horror, you're going to be thinking something like that. And I'm not totally sure that this is a horror movie, like Trey's first movie, Krisha, which was underseen but was one of the best movies I've seen over the last few years, certainly one of the most striking debuts. It's more of a harrowing psychological family drama. And I'm worried about its reception this weekend because it's being sold as a scary horror movie. Mm-hmm. It's using some of its more unsettling images in those trailers to make it look like it's a zombie scare you film. And that's not the takeaway. And people who are looking for that might be disappointed.
You know, it's interesting. I didn't see the trailer before I saw this movie. I just came in pretty blind. And what I got was a movie that's kind of trying to be two things simultaneously. It's trying to operate as an apocalyptic horror thriller. It has all those elements. It has to function that way. And yeah, it is trying to operate as a family drama. And I think it is remarkably inert on both ends. I had a really negative reaction to this movie. I found its ideas of suspense and dread to be incredibly monotone. And I found the family drama to be really perfunctory. It seems like it was just cycling through these really obvious bullet points we've come to expect of the apocalyptic genre. And they didn't have any particularly interesting moments of character to build that up, make it feel distinctive, make it feel special. And by the time the movie was over and it reaches its culmination, it reaches the point of why we're here, everyone in my theater, and myself included, was just like, that's it. That's all you got?
It is short. It's an hour and a half.
I don't mind short. I mind aggressively simplistic. Uh-huh. And I think it's trying to get away with how, like, oh, we're going to do this apocalyptic narrative and we're going to make it really straightforward. And isn't that interesting? Not necessarily. You actually have to do something. They keep toying with the idea that maybe there's something in the woods. Maybe this is all biblical. There's a lot of imagery on the art and the walls. And ultimately, the twist, I feel, is that there's nothing to it. It's a really straightforward movie, and I don't think it works.
I think from a plot perspective, yeah, it's not breaking any new ground, nor did Krisha. But he really imbues what he's doing with a lot of care, and it feels like it's coming from the heart and the gut. So while it is slow, deliberate, and not necessarily surprising in a genre way, I feel it viscerally in my body while I watch it in a way that I don't often.
All right. Well, we'll talk more about this coming up. We'll find out whether or not the director actually had all these intentions in mind when he made it. Kyle Buchanan, senior editor at New York Magazine's Vulture, where he writes about film. William Bibbiani, film editor for Crave Online. He also hosts the podcast Canceled Too Soon, which celebrates its 50th episode this weekend. Thank you both.
Thank you.
All right, Warren Olney, are there tapes or are there not tapes?
Well, the president says he will give an answer to that question very soon and said that perhaps the reporters will be disappointed. So we'll be talking about that a little bit at his latest news conference since the Comey testimony. We're also going to have a very interesting program about opioids and the extraordinary epidemic of opioid addiction, which is now the leading cause of death for people under 50 in the United States.
Leading cause of death, beating cancer, heart disease, car accidents.
Yeah, for people under 50. So states and others, they're beginning to sue pharmaceutical companies based on the same kind of thinking that went into the tobacco suits.
Okay, that's a great conversation to have. 1 o'clock, to the point, do not miss it. Thank you, Warren Olney. Coming up on this program, as I said, we're going to speak with the director of It Comes at Night, Trey Edward Schultz, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. We just heard from our film critics talking about It Comes at Night. One of them liked it, one of them didn't. It's writer-director Trey Edward Schultz's second feature. His first one that Kyle mentioned was the indie movie Krisha. It was a sometimes hilarious, sometimes cringe-inducing family drama starring his aunt, Krisha Fairchild. It Comes at Night is also a family drama, but with horror overtones.
We don't know what made Stanley sick. We don't know anything. Nobody touched him, so I think we're fine, right?
Positive.
You just opened the door, right? You didn't go in.
I didn't touch the door.
You did what?
It was already open.
Then who opened it?
Like many a scary film before it, It Comes at Night takes place in a remote house in the woods, at a time when people are being killed by some sort of horrible unnamed plague. Joel Edgerton stars as the dad trying to prevent his wife and teenage son from being infected. Trey Edward Schultz wrote and directed It Comes at Night, and he joins me now. Hi.
How are you?
Well, I'm fine. So I'm not infected yet. So
there you go.
Both of your movies, as I mentioned, are family dramas. So the drama happening mainly inside the home. What is it about the home that you find both thrilling and dangerous?
I think I have some kind of obsession with families. Uh-huh. You know, and then where are families? They're in homes. And I don't know. I'm drawn to that confinement and what happens to people in certain spaces. I will say I'm now that I've done two movies in single locations primarily, I'm so ready to not do that next time.
It's also good for, you know, the budget as well, just to shoot in one location.
Totally. Good for the budget. And, you know, my DP and I, we love like having our location and knowing every nook and cranny and how to explore it cinematically. And, you know, I think it's also just I love chamber dramas. I love chamber pieces. Mm. That's fun to me. And I like exploring characters' psyches. And if you have people contained to this place, how they contend with each other. And I don't know. It's just exciting to me.
So the family, so it's a man, a wife, and a teenage son. It's mixed race family. Was that casting done on purpose?
Not so much. It was primarily just where things went, you know. It was Joel, and then I found Carmen, and then I found Kelvin, and I'm so happy. That being said, you can't not think about that stuff. Now, in hindsight, I think it's really interesting that regardless of race, this is about how two families, these two tribes, relate to each other.
Right. So they have their house, and then this other family moves in, and it's another family of three.
Yes.
So I'm just wondering, there's a lot of mistrust between these two groups. They're so similar, and yet they're so different. Mm-hmm. And are you saying that they just can't bridge this mistrust because of the, you know, the unknown out there?
I like that word. I think that word you just said is a lot of what this movie's about, and the fear that instills, you know, fear of the unknown, and the different ways that can penetrate us, and you know, ultimate unknown being death. But you know, I don't know. Sorry, I'll ramble on and on if you let me.
Please do. So I'll let you ramble on and on because I'm really curious. This plague, okay. You never say where it comes from or why, and you, on purpose, yeah. Obviously, you want it to be mysterious. Is it metaphorical?
Oof, yeah. This one in particular, this movie, there's a lot of stuff going on between the seams and below the surface and subtext, and it comes from an extremely personal place put into a totally fictional narrative. And diseases in general scare me. Have you seen Contagion?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's
I remember seeing that movie and not wanting to touch anything and washing my hands after everything. But I think what I was inspired with this movie, I wrote it 2 months after I lost my dad. And we had a really tough relationship. He struggled with addiction for years and, well, my whole life, but for a good portion, he was good. And then he fell off the rails and we cut off our relationship. I hadn't seen him in 10 years. And then he got pancreatic cancer and I went to him on his deathbed. And he was so full of regret. And I was just trying to help him find peace and let him know it was okay to let go. And he didn't want to let go. And so 2 months after that, I started writing. And it started with that opening scene with a daughter saying goodbye to her father, like what I was saying goodbye to my dad.
But in terms of wanting to make a horror film versus a family drama about dying and family and addiction, I mean, that's a different beast altogether. Why did you want to do that?
Well, it's interesting. I never approached this as a horror movie or anything. It's just the story that came out of me and where it naturally went. And it was a big culmination of a lot of things. It was where my head was at the time and what I was thinking about. And I was reading books on genocide and I was thinking about mortality, you know, and my own death and my own fear of that and the regret my dad had and how I didn't want that. But then I was thinking larger than that. And I was thinking us as humans and these cycles of violence we do. It really scares me and how these cycles keep occurring and how things keep getting worse and worse. And regret kind of linked that to where I think a lot of the movie is about. There's a line, you know, there's a line you can cross where sometimes there's worse than death. And, you know, I don't think we should ever cross that line. And I see the movie as a cautionary tale in a lot of ways on that.
Is there, are there any bright moments, do you think, in this movie?
I know this is it's not the brightest movie. The next movie I want to do has a lot more life, but I do think what do you think? I think there's some brightness in the middle section. Did you?
Yeah. I mean,
a little bit.
Before the really bad stuff happens.
I know. Well, I always kind of saw the arc of it as we start in very bad heaviness. We get some light and some hope. And then it gets taken away again. And that's just kind of the arc that I think this story had to be told. But I hope some light is felt and I hope some love is felt in the movie.
Well, yeah, the family bond between, but you know, in both sets of families, the love that you encounter between them in their own little tiny unit of three is very strong. Yeah. It's just doesn't carry outside the unit.
No, I know.
So, I mean, this film, Krisha, you have obviously a very complicated view of family and not a particularly happy view of family.
I know. Everyone keeps bringing that up.
But
that doesn't make my mom too happy.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that.
Well, here's what I think. Clearly, I'm fascinated by it. I've done two movies about families, and I'm sure I'm going to do more. You know, both my mom and my stepdad are therapists. You know, therapy kind of gets to bringing stuff to light and talking about stuff you don't want to talk about and confronting it. And I think both of these movies are kind of about a confrontation. And I hope they make people talk about what they're about.
Trey Edward Schultz, he's the writer and director of the new movie It Comes at Night, and it's out in theaters today. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. This is a pleasure.
And Christian Bordahl is here now to round out the week.
Hey there, Madeline.
Hello.
Well, early on the show, we talked about whether Democrats will have a better chance of winning back Congress in the White House by following Bernie Sanders left or leaning to the center to try to pick up disaffected Trump voters. Aaron responded, "Are disaffected Trump voters even in the center? Go left and see what you find." Bill Graney said, put Pelosi, Feinstein, Schumer, Biden, etc. out to pasture, put some new young faces in front of the cameras, and explain to blue-collar America how they will be part of a transitioning economy. John Mata says L.A. Congressman Adam Schiff won't shut up about Russia. Meanwhile, L.A.'s homeless population is exploding. Will a Pence presidency get them off the street? And Ask Khan says, I think that if the Democrats can actually get some Republicans to partner with them to impeach, based on the Russia investigation, do it. If not, I feel we should really focus on the issues.
All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. Thanks, everyone who weighed in. Have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation. Rick and Suzanne Kane and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.